afternoon. This is Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. My guest today is Dr. Eric Motley, an executive vice president at the Aspen Institute. Before he joined the Aspen Institute, he worked in the U.S. State Department and was a special assistant to President George W. Bush. But he has humble roots in a small Alabama town. Dr. Motley has written a memoir called Madison Park, A Place of Hope, about growing up in this extraordinary community, which was full of support and selflessness. The values of determination and generosity that Dr. Motley learned there have continued to inform his life and work. I started out by asking him about the unique history of Madison Park.
In 1880, a group of freed slaves who newly emancipated decided they wanted to lay their claim on America, and they had their new freedom and a little money they had saved, and they purchased a plantation. Several families pulled their resources together, and they had nothing but the clothes on their back and a few dollars, but together they had more than they did individually. And they purchased a plantation, raised crops and sold cattle and grew livestock, built a cotton gin, bought a larger plantation, and established what is now Madison Park. And that's the place that I grew up in. And that's in Montgomery, Alabama.
And then can you read a bit for us?
Sure, by all means. This is taken from the final reflections of my book. A Washington, D.C. friend recently found himself at a conference in the company of a very successful white attorney from Montgomery. My friend immediately attempted to play the name and place game. "Do you know Eric Motley? He's from Madison Park." The attorney politely replied, "No, I don't know him, and where is Madison Park?" My friend was taken aback because he assumed, after hearing me talk about Madison Park so much over the last decade, everyone in Alabama, let alone Montgomery, knew of Madison Park. Telling me the story, he incredulously added, "The guy looked at me as if Madison Park did not exist, as if it were invisible." In many ways, I guess Madison Park does not exist on the radar of many navigational systems or printed maps, except for those who work in the municipal government and public schools of Montgomery, or who know of people or know the story of our community. Madison Park, no doubt, is invisible. An invisible Madison Park is an incredible idea for me, because to those who hail from the place, Madison Park is as much as an idea as it is a living, breathing organism. To those who have never heard of our little community, it may not exist, but to the founders who brought the land, cleared the brush, and laid the cornerstones, and to their descendants who still care for it, whether they live there or not, it is as large as America.
And by writing this memoir, you kind of have put Madison Park on the map. So what drove you to write this?
You know, we live in a politically frustrating time right now. We're more fragmented and polarized and culturally confused than ever before. And we hear a lot about what separates us and what divides us and what doesn't work. Let's make America great again. But this is a story about the greatness of America and how people who had very little except hope and aspirations and dreams created their own little American community. And so it's a wonderful opportunity to remind people that there are blessed ties that bind us, that there are institutions that we need to refocus our energies and our resources on, and those institutions are communities, and that there is power when people work together to achieve desired outcomes for themselves, for a larger community, for the country.
And much of the book centers on kind of the influence and the lessons from your grandparents, who were really your parents growing up. Mm-hmm. You call them Mama and Daddy in the book.
Daddy.
Can you describe them?
So Daddy was the grandson of one of the founders of Madison Park, one of those pioneers in 1880 who found this place. And he was named by his grandfather. His name is George Washington Motley. His grandfather named him such as to remind him of his own American birthright. And my grandfather enjoyed writing his name out. His grandfather said, "Never write George, never write GW, write your name out in its entirety." So he just took pleasure in writing George Washington Motley. He was a very smart man. He was stoic. He had very almost 18th century sensibilities. He was a Victorian in manner. He spoke very little, but he spoke with great concern and volume when he did speak. And everyone in Madison Park knew him. He was a carpenter who was mathematically very acute and curious and built most of the houses in our community and a lot of the black churches in Madison Park. A man of enormous civility and decorum. Now, my grandmother, who was born the same year as radio came out, was just like the radio. She never stopped talking. And if opposites could attract, George and Mamie were the ideal opposites.
Even physically, you include some pictures in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he was tall and dapper, uh-huh. and everyone thought he looked like Cary Grant, inasmuch as a black man could look like Cary Grant. And my grandmother was short. My grandfather was 6'2". My grandmother was like 5'2". She had a very Rubenesque composition physically and never stopped talking, was the life of every party, and really was the embodiment of community. That your concerns were her concerns, and she would worry herself just as much about a neighbor's issues as she would about our family issues. And the two of them just made a perfect couple together. Mm-hmm. And they were concerned about this little child that they had taken into their care, this bundle of unformed possibility. That's me. Mm-hmm. And they devoted all of their energies and all their resources and their prayers and their faith in trying to develop something out of this human material.
Mm-hmm. I think I was struck by your descriptions of them and them raising you. And it wasn't like they were indulgent necessarily. I mean, they gave you some tough love.
Gave me a lot of tough love. Yes. You know, we lived in a house where you didn't get a medal for showing up. Mm-hmm. You had to perform. And no one in our family had gone to college. Very few people in our community had gone to college. And so my grandfather had three great desires for me. That I realized that I was created by something larger than myself, that I was no less than the trees and the stars, and that I had a right to be here, that there was a God who created me with purpose. His second great aspiration was that I would have the understanding that I was a part of a community, a network that was much larger than our household. To use a term that we like at the Aspen Institute for Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, we're all a part of an inescapable network of mutuality. We're tied in a single garment of destiny, that I was a part of a community. Madison Park, a national community as well. And that lastly, he had a great desire that I could have the benefit of enlightenment that only an education could provide. And so that focus was rather intense. And at a very early age, it was instilled in me that there were great dreams and aspirations that they had for me and that other people had for me, that the community was making an investment in me, and that I needed to work hard, and that success looked like this. Mm-hmm. And so when I didn't achieve success, I didn't get a medal for not achieving success. I was given a very good conversation about what success looked like, how I should work harder, where my deficiencies were, how we could overcome those deficiencies with more hard work. My future depended on it.
Did you feel pressure or was that motivation?
I think it was, you know, I think it was a combination of everything. Number one, I was not born to the Motleys. I was chosen. So kids who are adopted are chosen people. Mm-hmm. I was chosen by these people, and they made an enormous investment, and I knew it. I was smart enough at an early age to realize that they were pouring a lot of stuff into me. Grandfather had gone back to work. Grandmother was a housekeeper. She had gone back to cleaning houses to make extra money so that she could have resources to buy me books and to allow me to participate in things that would be for my development. So I was very much aware that to whom much was given, much was required and greatly expected. So with that, came the excitement of being able to do what no one had done in the family before, go to college, experience the world, meet people, experience new ideas. That was exciting. And that was how they sold this. You know, this is about investing in a world of possibilities beyond your knowing it now. And with that came discipline and focus and commitment. And those are very important virtues that I think any person who wants to succeed or achieve anything should learn at a very early age.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. My guest today is Dr. Eric Motley, an executive vice president at the Aspen Institute. He came into the studio to discuss his memoir, Madison Park, A Place of Hope. We'll be back after a short break. You talked about community as something that drove you to write this. And this book really seems like a love letter in a way to the place that you grew up. It's this incredibly supportive, interwoven community. So can you talk a little bit more about those connections and that support that you grew up with?
So I started off by telling you about my grandparents and their focus on my development and growth. In a community, everything is communal. In a real community, you suppress your individual aspirations if it's at the expense of the aspirations of the entire enterprise. Mm-hmm. And so in Madison Park, everyone kind of realized that we're in this together. We win together, we lose together. And we can't allow anyone to fail. And so my grandparents unashamedly made their aspirations the aspirations of everyone who lived on our street. He wants to go to college. We want him to go to college. How can you help us help him to go to college? And so when I look back, and it's always interesting to look in the rearview mirror of life because you see things a lot more clear than when you're going 50 miles an hour. My grandfather, who had never gone to the Montgomery Public Library himself, my mother being one of the first groups of students to leave the town to integrate the public schools in the city of Montgomery, had never been to the Montgomery Public Library. This was a no-no to blacks in Montgomery, Alabama. And so when I came along, I had access to the Montgomery Public Library, and my grandfather would drive me to the library. When he couldn't drive me to the library on Saturdays, he would ask neighbors or other members of the community. These were farmers. These were livestock keepers. These were plumbers and carpenters who had never been into this beautiful building, who would drive their cars, park their cars in the parking lot, and sit and wait for 2 hours, too emotionally overwhelmed to go into a place that they had been forbidden, but realized that all the promise of my future in Madison Park laid in the fact that I could actually go in. And they did that for a couple of years. There's another wonderful story about a group of retired teachers who organized themselves when I was failing in my reading group at school, and how they intervened, and my grandmother engaged them, and they came by my house every day for 2 years for 2 hours. And these were muscular women, muscular in physique and in faith and in constitution. And they were pretty serious. And so they would come into my dining room. They transformed my dining room into a classroom. And one of the first assignments was for me to memorize the preamble to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And James Weldon Johnson's Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is a poem written by an African-American poet. And then we would move into mathematics and social security and social studies, not social security, right. Which gave me great security later. Yeah. And then she would throw in a little Latin. And why the preamble to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence? This was the granddaughter of Eli Madison, and she wanted me to realize that part of my responsibility was not to just become academically whole, but to realize my own responsibility as a citizen. And what better way to be reminded than studying the precepts of our own founding as a country, especially in this community that was founded by freed slaves who just wanted a little taste of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so this entire community, at every turn, was there cheering me on, supporting me, helping me, giving me $2, $5 to go off to camp. Little money, but much sacrifice to many of them.
Do you think Madison Park is unique, or do communities like that exist and we don't hear about them, or they're overlooked because they don't kind of fit narratives that we have about race or class or even small towns, I guess, in this day and age?
You know, Madison Park for me has become a metaphor for community. It's become a metaphor also for the places that we don't know about, that are not on our GPS systems. Some people refer to them as flyover places or flyover states. And if anything, in this last election, we've realized that people in those places matter, and they speak, and they vote, and they have opinions, and they want to be a part of this larger narrative and this larger conversation that some of us are having in this country. And so, Aspen, This is an incredible community. Aspen, Colorado, when I come here, the people who know each other, the relationships, the commitment that people have. I work at the Aspen Institute. Robert Hurst and Soledad Hurst have given a very large gift to make sure that kids in the Roaring Fork community can participate in Aspen Institute programming. And I was just speaking to someone who was reminding me of the importance of helping the new president to realize that people in Aspen, Colorado, the community and the Roaring Fork have very important goals and aspirations that we could help them with. And so there are concerned citizens here. I spoke at the Rotary Club this morning who want to invest in helping people and creating a real sense of place. So community varies in its tone and its color and its composition. I grew up in a poor community where people worked together to make sure that no one was left behind. I think those communities exist to varying degrees. I think, if anything, this love letter to Madison Park is a love letter to the idea of community, to help us to remember how important it is to restore a moral vocabulary that helps us to feel a level of connectivity beyond the things that are different about us.
What's the recipe for that now, for creating a community?
Community means that you have to make some sacrifices for the good of the whole. A community means that you have to step outside of your comfort zone and that you have to try to understand instead of always trying to be understood. It means that you might need to leave Aspen to go to Carbondale, right? That you might need to leave Madison Park to go into the wealthy community of Cloverdale. It means that every now and then you should stop and sit down in the back of a mosque or a synagogue or a church to try to understand how other people orientate their lives to their God. It takes your having conversations with people that perhaps you wouldn't have conversations with in order to understand the similarities and not the differences. And in understanding the similarities, i.e. through conversation, you discover that, you know, we all want our kids to get a good education. We all have aging parents. Most of us have someone in our family who's suffering from cancer or who's suffering from some other disease. And we start conversing about how we're dealing with those issues and how we're dealing with those hopes and aspirations. And we start to look alike and to feel alike. And we feel we realize that we're all a part of one great chorus line.
So one of the things that you just talked about was the importance of selflessness in a community. And you have an excerpt from your book I'm going to ask you to read that speaks to that idea of gratitude.
For as long as I can remember, my indebtedness to others has been a prism through which my life experience was filtered. That awareness has served to keep my vanity at bay and impel my concern for others. From my first days, I was taught by example to count my blessings. Though their total now runs so high I can no longer name them one by one, the composite sense of having been blessed is my most cherished possession. The abundance I found in life, thanks to everyday mentors, fortuitous circumstances, and providence, far outweighs what I might have earned or what I deserve.
Can you speak to the importance of gratitude in your life, both growing up in Madison Park and now?
When you have so little, everything is a gift. And so my grandparents, if anything, worked really hard at helping me to focus on that which could be, the promise of the unknown, the potentiality of life, the gifts of life. Gosh, when I look back and I think of all the people who have, by their thoughts, their words, or their deeds, influenced my way of thinking and my development, I am so overcome with such an enormous sense of gratitude that I hardly want to step outside of my apartment. But the motivation is, I don't want to step outside of my apartment fearing that I would incur more debt. But the greatness is that it's my motivation to step outside of my apartment. For whom much is given, much is expected. And it's my opportunity to try to give back as much as I can with as little as I have.
That was Dr. Eric Motley, an executive vice president at the Aspen Institute and author of the memoir Madison Park, A Place of Hope. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. I want to talk about your life now a little bit. You collect rare books.
I do,
right?
Yes.
First editions. Yeah. And Samuel Johnson sounds like one of your favorites. And it strikes me, you describe the community donating books to help you kind of have a home library when you were young in Madison Park. That just seems like, I don't know, there is some symbolism or some connection there about this incredible arc of your life.
You bet there's a connection. And at the time, I probably didn't imagine or comprehend the connection. It goes back to this Aunt Shine, mm-hmm. this woman who my grandmother singled out to come and to intervene to tutor me. Aunt Shine stood up at church the following Sunday after the teacher sent a note home to my grandmother informing her that I had been demoted from the rabbits reading group, that's the accelerated readers, mm-hmm. to the turtles.
Not the turtles.
So my grandmother, I like to say my grandmother's not one to discriminate, but she knows the difference between rabbits and turtles. And Aunt Shine got a telephone call saying, come over to the house, we got a problem, the teacher sent a note home, Eric's not doing good in reading, could you help us? And Aunt Shine decided that she would create this tutorial program for me, which, by the way, eventually turned into a community-wide tutorial program. But Aunt Shine, that following Sunday, had asked the minister if she could make an announcement at church. It was as if it was a public service announcement. And she stood up and she said, brothers and sisters, one of our little stars in this community, Eric Motley, has become cast by the shadows of learning. And I need you to help me help him to regain his status as a rabbit. I'm going to be at his grandparents' house this afternoon on the back porch, and I'm going to be tutoring him, and I want to build him a library. And whatever reading matter that you have at your house, if you could drop it by the Motley's house this afternoon, I and his grandparents will be there to receive it. And that afternoon, you would have thought that a paper drive was taking place. People brought whatever they had. They wanted to be a part of this. That's community. We want to be a part of helping this child realize his potential. Someone brought a 1945 almanac predicting weather that year, a 1972 Life magazine. But someone also brought a wonderful volume of English verse. Without its table of contents, without its index, without its cover, but thickly sewn with Shakespeare, with Keats, with Tennyson, with Wordsworth, with Shelley, with Byron. And it was that volume of verse that was left at my house. I don't remember who left it, that transformed my love of literature and learning. And so in my bedroom, my grandfather built a bookcase that went around the entire room so that I could put all of these books and other curiosities that I picked up on my afternoon excursions through nature. And I just grew up with these books, the beautiful bindings, not expensive books, not really important books, but decorative books that possessed all the knowledge of the world. And these thin little sheaves were all the rich learnings and inspirations of some of the greatest writers of the universe, right there, contained in 25, 30 pages in my bedroom. And so my love of learning and my love of the tool, the book as a tool, the book as an ornament, the book as a vessel, only increased with the passage of time. And then I started collecting books, and I got really into the high-end sport of it. That's where all of my Aspen Institute salary goes.
That's right. Well, speaking of Aspen Institute, can you talk about what you do there now?
Gosh, I feel like I do so much. Mm-hmm. I came to the Aspen Institute 10 years ago this January. I was a Henry Crown Fellow when I worked at the White House, and that was my first exposure to the Aspen Institute. I met Walter Isaacson that same year and his wife, Kathy, who befriended me and had me over for Thanksgiving dinner because they discovered I was a neighbor of theirs in Georgetown. And Walter told me all about his great vision for the Aspen Institute. He was just hired, yet to start. And we became friends, and he said to me, whenever you're ready to leave the White House, let me know. I'd love to have you at the Aspen Institute. I ended up leaving the Aspen Institute and going to the State Department to help run some Fulbright programs. And the moment came where it was time for me to think about what was next. And Walter, out of the blue, reached out to me and said, "The founding director of the Henry Crown Fellowship Program is retiring. So I would love for you to come to the Aspen Institute to run the Henry Crown Fellowship Program. I'll give you another title so that you could work on other special projects and work with things that I'm interested in, and we'll make this work." And what an invitation. What an invitation of a lifetime. So I came to the Aspen Institute running the Henry Crown Fellowship Program. I took on other things. I ran a commission to reform the federal appointments process between the White House and the Senate. Eventually, I created something called Aspen Across America, which was an initiative to take the Aspen Institute on the road to cities across the country, to communities. And my role has evolved now to a role where I serve as executive vice president in charge of institutional advancement. That's stewarding all of the philanthropic relationships that we have and engaging new audiences to learn about the Aspen Institute and to take an interest in what we do. And then I serve as secretary to the board. Jim Crown is our chair. We have a very influential and engaged board, and I got the great pleasure of working with our board members to help them realize their own aspirations for the Aspen Institute. And more recently, helping to manage the search for the new president of the Aspen Institute. So, yeah.
I'm just curious, in your work now, are there concrete ways that you still feel that mama and daddy influence you? Like, have there been times when you've heard their voices?
I hear their voices every day. Do what's right. Seek truth and beauty. They help inform my way of thinking about the role of the Aspen Institute and our role in reaching the unreachable and embracing the rejected and creating systems where we can engage people in communities that don't have the good fortune of coming to Aspen or coming to Washington and engaging our programming. It helps me to think more sympathetically and more empathetically about how we create conversations and curate conversations that seek to understand other people and to engage those people in the conversation and in the discourse. We have a very noble mission at the Aspen Institute, and that is to enlighten, inspire, and engage, and to help people to find some common ground. And so there are not a lot of people from communities like Madison Park who would find themselves at the Aspen Institute at convenings, let alone working at the Aspen Institute. And so how do we find those people who are very much a part of this American narrative, and how do we give them the opportunity of sharing their story from Appalachia to the African-American communities to the Native American communities? Those are very important voices that are not commonly easily heard. And so that's a very important part of our mission and our work, and to be a part of trying to drive that in a very significant way and moving thought to action is a noble calling that I'm glad to be a part of. Thank
Eric,
you.
Eric, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. I'm extremely grateful. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cross Currents. I'm Kristen Kay. My guest today was Dr. Eric Motley, an executive vice president at the Aspen Institute. Before he joined the Aspen Institute, he worked in the U.S. State Department and was a special assistant to President George W. Bush. He's the author of the memoir, Madison Park, A Place of Hope. To listen to other Cross Currents interviews, you can go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Cross Currents is a production of Aspen Public Radio.